Coming up in today's Ideaspace podcast.
There is no point in an entrepreneurial journey, no matter how accomplished you may be, that you will think, okay, I know everything and I know how to do it all and I can do it myself. I heard somebody say this once, I cannot remember where, but they just said, nobody's going to steal your idea. The truth is that the hardest part is the execution. But I would say that the most enjoyable part of it is the now. It's the everyday of it. I really love what I do. And I love that I'm still learning.
Welcome to the Ideaspace podcast. I'm Ben Hartley, head of Ideaspace. Ideaspace is a community of entrepreneurs, founders and their teams, many of them working alongside each other in one of our three offices based in and around Cambridge. Our members share knowledge, experience and expertise to help themselves and others in their high-impact venture creation. Today, I'm speaking with Amaima Ahmad, the CEO and co-founder of 52 North, a multi-award-winning medtech company focused on reinventing the healthcare journey, starting by transforming cancer care with NutriCheck. Amaima is a former business development professional and banking lawyer and is a seasoned negotiator of significant M&A and licensing transactions with values in the billions of dollars. In 2022, Amaima was recognized on Management Today's 35 Under 35 Women in Business, and in 23, 52 North became the first ever venture investment of Macmillan Cancer Support. In today's podcast, we'll discover the story behind 52 North and Amaima's entrepreneurial journey. We'll also talk about business and innovation, raising funds, and Amaima's passion, championing women to pursue STEM subjects and careers.
Right, Amaima, hello, and thank you so much for joining us today. And this is actually being recorded in the West Hub in Cambridge, and this podcast is going out as a special for Cambridge Tech Week. Right, before we delve into the story behind the startup and what led you to start 52 North, can you tell us a little bit about NutriCheck, the company's sort of first main endeavor?
Yeah, absolutely, Ben, and thank you for having me. So NutriCheck is a solution which we've built to improve safety and quality of life for cancer patients. And so it consists of both a piece of hardware and a piece of software. So we've got the medical device, it's a finger prick blood test, and a digital platform. And the intention is to help address a problem that a lot of chemotherapy patients across the world face, and that's something called neutropenic sepsis. So neutropenic sepsis is the most fatal side effect of chemotherapy treatment. And because it can be fatal, what happens at the moment is that anybody who's undergoing chemotherapy, whenever they feel unwell, even if it's something like a fever, they're required under current NICE guidance to rush straight into the A&E. And the reason for this is because there's this risk of a condition that can be fatal and kills about three people in England and Wales every day. And so the key priority in that situation is to make sure that these patients get their antibiotics, which can help them. And the delay in antibiotics, so every hour's delay actually results in an increase in mortality risk by about 7%. So it is really important to get them treated.
Right. So I mean, it sounds like something that it isn't necessarily well publicized. I mean, I understood that, you know, there are risks for patients and undergoing chemotherapy, but hadn't actually heard of that before I'd heard of you.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, what we've found, so we've been working with the innovation community at Macmillan for a while, and so we've been liaising and working with a lot of patients who have contributed to our product development. And what we found is that actually, when a patient starts this journey and they're learning about their treatment, there's a lot of information thrown at them. And they often have, you know, worries like hair loss and other things which are much more tangible to them. And many of those patients have never actually heard the words neutropenic sepsis before. But what they have heard is that an infection can be fatal. So if you do feel sick, call and come straight in.
Right, which is obviously going to probably result in people calling a lot and trying to get in a lot because they don't know. And if you don't know, you're not going to take a risk. So I guess that's part of the solution that you're solving.
Yeah, absolutely. So that is exactly the case. So patients, I mean, there's two pieces to this. One is that a lot of patients do come in a lot because they worry, and they do that rightly, because at the moment there's no way of knowing if you're at risk of neutropenic sepsis until you've got to hospital and they've done a full blood test. The other part of that is actually we found that in terms of behaviours, some people don't take it as seriously, and they, because they don't necessarily understand what the condition is and how fatal it can be. And it's also very difficult to say, well, you know, am I really unwell? Am I just kind of, is this in my head? Maybe I'm fine. I'll just wait a little while. But no clinician wants their patient to wait. If they feel unwell, they shouldn't risk it. And so that's the other behavior that, you know, that we're hopefully able to address, because people do delay going into hospital a lot, particularly if there are things like childcare to arrange if you need to rush in. So it's particularly prevalent where you've got lower socioeconomic backgrounds, or you've got other considerations like work and things that might be holding you back from coming in, or simply you just don't want to. In many cases, it's that you don't want to bother the doctor, which is, you know, it's, I think it's almost very British, but it's also just very human to say, oh, I'm probably okay, and so I don't want to bother anyone. NutriCheck will hopefully provide that peace of mind to patients, because it's a finger prick blood test that you can do at home. You input the result into the app, and alongside other information about yourself, like the type of drug that you're on, you're told at the end of that process whether or not you're high risk or low risk effectively. And your clinician can make a decision based on that as to whether you should rush in, or actually whether you can stay at home, be seen by your GP or otherwise. And so it should really help the patient as well by empowering them with the knowledge that they need to take that decision.
Mm. That's. I'd love to hear more about the actual, or we will talk about the actual MedTech device. But before we do that, it'd be quite interesting to wind the clock right back to find out how you have ended up founding and running this company. So so if we do go back a bit, you read law at King's College London, and also spent a year in Strasbourg, the university there. So how did that come about then? The journey started off on law, and now you've ended up here.
It's a slightly
tell me a bit
unusual.
About that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll go back 1 year earlier, actually. So my A-level subjects were mathematics, ICT, so IT, and French. I had two STEM subjects in there and one art. I think at that stage, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and everything I looked at in the university prospectus was sort of equally unfamiliar to me. So law, I vaguely understood it and thought, okay, maybe I'm good at writing and I could probably do this. So that's the path I followed initially, and I did work as a banking lawyer for a number of years, and most recently I was in-house counsel at Citibank, and I enjoyed what I did very much, and so it was a sort of I don't know if I should say accidental.
It happens in life, and interestingly, it does happen. I talked to a number of entrepreneurs and about their journey, and it can be a series of accidents that bring them in there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So serendipitous, maybe I'd say. So, you know, if we can actually, you know, get to market and have this impact, then it's really just the way things turned out. So I was living in Cambridge and commuting in to Canary Wharf every day. I decided that I wanted to be closer to home. And I undertook a master's degree when I was on maternity leave in 2016. And that master's program was in Bioscience Enterprise. So it's a program that a lot of entrepreneurs have come out of, actually, and done amazing things. My driver for going onto that course was really just to get to know the industry, the pharma industry, the biotech industry, a little bit more before taking the jump and practicing as a lawyer in this world. So initially I did go on and started working in business development at AstraZeneca, so working on transactional work like M&A and licensing deals, and that was the more natural transition. But while you're on that course, they do a lot of, so they teach you bioscience, biotech, a lot about drug development, device development, things like that. But they also teach you a number of the programs from the MBA course, you know, kind of company valuations and things on the finance side. As part of that program, they encourage the students to come up with ideas and pitch those ideas. And there's various competitions that happen at the university. So the one thing I'd say is that I don't think this would have happened anywhere else in the world. It happened because of the ecosystem in Cambridge. There were competitions at the university and saying, you know, submit a business plan, come up with an idea, and you take part. And, you know, sometimes they don't go anywhere, sometimes they do. And the very start of that journey was sort of talking to one of my co-founders who's an oncologist practicing at Cambridge University Hospitals Trust. And I was saying to him, you know, what are the issues that you see day to day working in the NHS?
And what, you know, what were the gaps and what were the pinch points? And that's where neutropenic sepsis was first mentioned to me and was identified as an issue that needed tackling.
Do you know, it's really awful for patients because they have to come in and they feel stressed about having to come in. And if they don't come in, they're anxious as well, that they think they may not have made the right decision. And, you know, if only there was a way of letting them know earlier on in that journey that actually they're fine and they can stay at home, or actually they need to rush in. And so that's where it all started. And then we basically built, we had a couple of co-founders. So the other two co-founders, one is a biosensor engineer and the other is a data scientist and assistant professor here at the University of Cambridge. Now, with all our different disciplinary backgrounds, it was all about just doing some hard graft and putting together a potential business plan, thinking about what this could look like, how might we solve it, what kind of technology would we need.
And was that obviously you asked that that question of what is a problem that might need solving, was that specifically for competition, or was it just did that question come out of part of your studies for the masters?
Yeah, so during the masters, because they ask us to come up with ideas that we can pitch, right, as a just for fun, actually, just for practice, really. So my colleagues on the course and I would often sit down, and I remember once we had this idea that we thought was brilliant about sort of enabling detection of spiked drinks using your nail polish, and then we Googled it and found out it had already been done. Wow. So, and that's what happened with most of the things. We thought, oh, there's a gap here, maybe we could do this. And so it was really the curiosity that gets built out of that program. It challenges you to question where the gaps are.
And at that stage, did you actually think that it would be something that you would form, or did that not occur to you until sort of it was too late?
So I think actually it didn't become tangible for a long time. So it was almost a project that we did because we enjoyed, you know, building a business plan and learning new skills. So I personally am somebody who constantly loves to learn, and if it's something new I've never done before, I'll give it a go, and you know, it's just continuous improvement. And so the university has this postdoc business plan competition, it was a 6-month program where you get mentored and you build out a multi-page business plan that's somewhat more viable than what you could do, a lot more viable than what you could do at home by yourself. And then that culminates in a pitching event at the end if you get to the finals. And we got to the finals and we won a prize there, which was the initial funding, the first ever funding we received, which was a £10,000 award from Cambridge Enterprise. And so I think that's the moment when it became real for us, because we suddenly realized that we don't have a bank account and we have nowhere to put this money. So, and actually we don't have any plans for what to do with it, because this was just an idea that we were sort of developing. And so I think that's when it became real for the first time. And then after that, it was sort of getting our first grant and all of those firsts that turned into something. But the one thing I would add is that I think the first time that we realized it was worth pursuing was when we entered another competition called the Palmy Prize, which takes place at Pembroke College. And this is run by and funded by an entrepreneur, one of the Cambridge Angels called Richard Palmy, who's been incredibly successful. And he funds this program. And he came and spoke to us after our pitch and just said to us, I understand the problem that you're talking about. I know exactly what this is, and it would be great if you could do something about it. And he offered us mentorship. He just took us under his wing and just said, if there's anything I can do, let me know, you know, reach out if there's anything. And I think one of the key learnings we've had from this whole experience is that when people offer help, they do mean it and take them up. Even if you don't, you know, I think initially my thought was, oh gosh, what are we going to say to him? We don't really have anything. But that's how it always starts. And so it was a matter, we then went and met him at his offices one day and sat down with him, and he took time to kind of go through with us, how do you get funded for this? What do you do for a grant? What do you present to people? What do they want to see? What are the things you shouldn't be doing at this stage? And so having somebody like that, and I think there've been several other people as well who've been really critical in contributing to that very early journey, gave us faith that this was something that could be done. And hearing from somebody accomplished that, oh yeah, this is great, maybe you should do this and let us know how we can help, was just a real sort of turning point for us.
It it feels really early, or listening to the story early on, that there's lots of points of that journey that without sort of the business plan competition, or without the mentorship, or without you know, these various bits of help and support, that that it might not have got off the ground. It seems that Cambridge is I don't know whether it's unique, but it certainly feels that way in the fact that there's a lot of organisations that are just really there to get an idea that is clearly one that is could have huge impact, and to just help it along that early start of the journey.
Yeah, and I think that's where a lot of people fall over, in that you hear a lot of ideas, and I think this is one of those things that people often say, at the early stage, you often get people who say, well, you shouldn't tell people about your idea. But it's actually the complete opposite. And I heard somebody say this once, I cannot remember where, but they just said, nobody's going to steal your idea. The truth is that the hardest part is the execution. The idea, there are many, many ideas out there, and it's all about executing. And so it's the ecosystem in Cambridge, the competitions, the mentorship that's provided here, and the early funding opportunities are the game changers. Those are what enable you to actually move something forward and develop it into something that's, in writing, and then something you can pursue for applications for funding or grant applications, whatever it may be. I think the environment here does force you into execution, and just show you their way, kind of light that pathway in the early stages.
So you've got an idea that's clearly got interest and backing, whether it be from through the prize for the competition, or from the mentorship, etc., or from Cambridge Enterprise. But now you've got to the point where you just realise you need a physical product. So you've got people believing in you, and then I guess you've got to sort of start believing yourself and saying, right, we need to actually create this physical product. So how does that start? I mean, within your group of experts that you have, your co-founders, was there someone that had built a medtech device before from scratch?
And that's what I think is it's really important to have ambitious and ambitious people around you who are willing to learn and find avenues, because there is no point in an entrepreneurial journey, no matter how accomplished you may be, that you will think, okay, I know everything and I know how to do it all and I can do it myself. I don't think even people at huge organizations know every bit of the piece of work that they're about to embark on. And so for us, one of those, the very earliest piece of work that we did was with a CRO. So you have to work with other organizations.
And when you say CRO, for the people
who might not... Yeah, so a contract research organization. So basically you subcontract a company who has a lab and workspace and expertise in developing, in our case, it's lateral flow-based technology. That's the way you start. If you've only got a small amount of funding, and in our case it was £10,000 in that initial competition, you can probably get a little piece of work done. And in our case, what we did was do our very early proof of concept work. So it was effectively trying to look at whether or not it was possible to measure neutrophils in a home environment. And so it's a very early piece of work, but it just gives you that initial confidence that this may be something that can be done.
And was that enough that you could then raise more money needed, or did it work like that?
Yeah, so the next stage after that was very much looking at grant options and grant funding, because again, you're very early, and so grants, I mean, that's one of the fantastic things about this country. We do have, through UKRI and the Innovate UK programme, we do have access to a lot of potential opportunities. And so we applied for an Innovate UK Smart Grant. So, it is a feat applying for a grant. I think it's much more familiar to academics, and I'm not short of those in my team either. But it's a lot of graft, but it's absolutely worth it. And I think the more you do, the better you get at them. And it's almost, it's about selling the vision and explaining what you could achieve. And you do need to think big. You need to think about, if this was to take off, what could we achieve? What impact could we actually have? And what kind of job creation would this lead to? Because that's what, funders are looking for, is, how could you have an impact on the economy here? So the next thing we did was this Innovate UK grant, which was successful. And that was in the amount of about £125,000. And so that's where we were actually able to hire our very first employee. And so that was, again, a very big milestone.
Yeah, that must have been incredibly exciting for you and also daunting, I guess, because you knew that's the point. As soon as you hire someone, you're responsible for them and their journey. So, yeah, you know that you're kind of on the path. At this stage, are you just working from home or did you move into an office before?
So no, not at this point at all. So I was still working full time, and at this point, the employee that we hired was part time, and she was working from home. We didn't have office space yet, and I think, you know, those first hires are so important. And I would say again that the team around me who helps me to make that decision, who helped to come to that consensus on who we brought on, was so influential and so important because they saw things that I didn't necessarily see. So, you know, it was all of the co-founders who were at these interviews, and we really sort of discussed with each other what the attributes we were looking for were. I think one of the key learnings we've had is that you have to hire for attitude, and skills can be taught. And so that initial hire was so important. We got a fantastic person who joined our team, initially part-time, and, you know, was really leading the project. She was our project manager at the start, now she heads up our operations. And, you know, she obviously had faith in what we were doing and liked us as a team and wanted to work with us. But yeah, at that point, it was all sort of weekends and late nights for us as co-founders and a part-time employee.
Gosh. And was there, I hope I can ask this, was there any stage that you just thought, what have I got myself into? Because when things happen as a sequence of events, you can sometimes not necessarily be in control of them because you, as an entrepreneur or an innovator, you see the problem that's in front of you and you solve it and you keep solving it until you suddenly realize that you're a long way down the path. Did you ever think, what am I doing?
So I think it dawned on me how big this had gotten when I started thinking about needing to leave my job at AstraZeneca. I loved working there. It was a fantastic organization and I was part of a really great team. And I was constantly learning and being given new opportunities. And so I had never really contemplated that stage would come. So when we were raising our first round, that was our pre-seed in 2021, that's when, you know, our funders were saying, well, you know, are you going full time? and when? So for me, it dawned on me when I was considering having to leave my job, my full-time job, which was obviously a big moment. But that was obviously a big decision to make because you are then going all in when you sort of stop the job that's paying your bills and go full-time in your startup. At the same time, though, I would say that I was really excited because it opens up the potential. You've got all these ideas when you're working on a project part-time. You've got all these ideas that you think, oh, if only there was someone who could start that work stream. And it never stops because even now, despite being full-time and having we're a team of 12 now, that inspiration and that thinking doesn't stop. And you're always thinking, oh, if only there was somebody else here who we could help to do this thing, because there's so much you can potentially pursue in terms of opportunity. But that was the moment for me where it was, but it was very clear for me that, of course, this is something I would love to do. And it was, again, it was a new learning experience. It allowed me to use a lot of my transferable skills from my previous career as a lawyer, but also as a business development transactor in the pharma industry. And I'd also taken on some roles as an NED within the health tech industry. So I saw why this was something that I would be a good fit for. It was taking the plunge, but it's been fantastic because I really understand why it was important to make that leap.
Mm. You'll remember Ideaspace, and Ideaspace is a home to many early stage startups and founders. And the great thing for us is to actually see companies grow and teams grow. And you've mentioned that you've grown now to 12 in total. At what point did you realize that you were almost switching from a founder to a manager? Because that does happen where, you know, the founders, it's all about the innovation or the product and building a team. Then suddenly a team is there and you find yourself drawn into managing people. Was that not, I wouldn't say an overnight thing, but was there a point that you realized I'm managing a large team as opposed to having my own, you know, the many hats that you might have worn before?
Yeah, and it's It's been quite organic because it's happened over the space of like the last year and a half, where we've really gone from sort of 1 to 2 to 3 to 5 to 10 to 12. And so it creeps on you and you don't realize until you look back at your calendar and think, how much time did I actually spend working and how much time was I managing or, you know, thinking about not necessarily HR, but things that are really important. So I think it's really important for a founder to be involved in those conversations, whether it's about career development opportunities. And that's really important to us as a team. You know, we really believe that we've pulled together a really great team of people. And we want to see them develop and stay with us and grow their careers with us. So it happened very incidentally. I think what you then have to do is obviously try to learn to delegate. You have to learn to delegate. And actually what you've got to remember is that the team around you is an asset and it can actually make your life easier if you're able to give somebody else responsibility for something that you used to do.
And it's quite hard to, you know, we see founders who talk about how difficult it is because you've worn all the hats very early on and you have a sense of ownership of each of the sort of parts of the organization. And then when you hire someone to give them that, it's quite hard to give those all away in a way.
Yeah, it is a difficult transition to make and it's a skill that you need to learn. And I think I started learning it in prior jobs. So it's it wasn't completely new to me, but it still is that the more, especially when it's your own thing, something that you founded. For example, one of the things I used to do from the very beginning was I was always the person doing the finances and planning how we'd spend funding, everything like that. And I thankfully have nothing to do with that anymore, just a very, you know, very high level oversight of it because someone in my team is very capable and able to do that work. And so I think you never completely push things away. You will always have some level of oversight, but it is nice to be able to, you know, give people responsibility and then see them learn. And yeah, sometimes you will need to help them along or, you know, give them direction. Sometimes you'll need to help them get training. But actually overall, it's opening up your capacity to do things that are more valuable and better ways of spending your time and actually helping the business to grow.
Yeah. Can I just touch, you mentioned that you had your first raise. We do get people asking a lot of the early stage founders as well about sort of, well, I was going to say, if there's looking back after you've raised the money, what advice would you have given yourself beforehand, if you know what I mean?
There are three key things that I think I would have liked to have known. So three key pieces of advice. Number one is raise more than you think you need, because you can never overestimate the cost of things and the other work streams that come along, things like regulatory and legals and HR related things and you know, office space. There's always something you haven't factored in. And so, you know, don't be tight with budget, I suppose, is the takeaway there. You know, really think about and expand and make sure you include a buffer. The second thing I would say is raises always take longer than you think they will. So ensure that you've left enough time, you've got enough runway. If it's your first raise, just keep that in mind. And the third thing would be look for investors who fit with your values. So it's very tempting. There are lots of investment potential investors out there. And, you know, if you're lucky, you will get your chance to select those you want to work with. So I think the point is to say that, you know, don't just go with the first people that you talk to. Think about what your vision is for the company. Do you want to exit within 3 years and just be done and retire? Or are you looking to grow a big company and you're in it for the long haul? What are your ambitions for this organization as it grows? And what are your values as a company? So we, as a co-founding team, and I think we've certainly hired people who align with our values as well. But I think it's really nice to have that cohesion. And I think we share that with our investors as well. And so we've been very lucky in terms of the people we've been able to bring in terms of the support they are able to provide outside of funding, whether that's connections to other investors or whether it's connections to clinicians or to hospitals or to people who can advise you on the business side. So I would absolutely say, you know, if you, when you're planning on who to reach out to, maybe start by reaching out to the people that you're not that interested in and save your ideal investors for a little bit later once you've had a bit of practice and you've honed your pitch and you've taken a few Q&A sessions and know how to answer questions. I think by the end of it, you'll become incredibly fluent in answering every question out there possible. And so it is really important to just plan that outreach rather than just going gung-ho and sending emails out to everybody. Mm.
Yeah, that's well. I think you ended up with about five brilliant tips and advice there, which is incredibly useful. So, in this year, you became the first ever venture investment of Macmillan Cancer Support. Can you tell us about how that came about?
So, we first met Macmillan Cancer Support as an organisation at an event organised by the Eastern Academic Health Science Network, so the AHSN, where they were showcasing some technologies, and Macmillan were also there. And so our relationship began there. It was a couple of years ago now. We've been engaging with a number of people living with cancer through their innovation community since. So we've partnered with Macmillan on a number of projects and pieces of work. And the intention behind that has always been to put the patient at the center of our product development process to make sure that everything from how you use the device. So in our case, as an example of this, there were several mechanisms by which you could make an action happen on the device. So you need to turn something, or you could pull something, or, you know, press down a button. And we were thinking about patients who are on chemotherapy and whether they might feel weak, or they might have, sort of in some cases, this peripheral neuropathy. And so you need to think about those things and make sure you're including them in part of your assessment. So we did a number of usability, sort of formative usability studies with this community. We also did a number of exercises in terms of getting their input on our digital platform. And so all of this sort of early work enabled us to build a really good relationship with Macmillan. I think it was very clear from the outset that we were aligned in terms of our values. When this potential opportunity came about for investment, it was a no-brainer for us. And it was something that our investors were also, you know, very happy to see happening. We are really thrilled to be part of Macmillan's portfolio and to be the first ever company that they invested in this way. I think it's something that we're incredibly proud of. And now it's all about execution for us and delivering for those patients who have helped us.
Right. In terms of the product itself and where you are now, I guess, you know, medtech devices, or in fact anything in healthcare, is going to take a long time to actually get, I was going to say, to market, and I want to speak a little bit about that in a second. But where are you now with the device? Is it going through trials? When is it good to go out to users?
So we're planning our clinical trials for later this year, and that's going to, the main site for that will be Adam Brooks Hospital in Cambridge. And we hope to submit for regulatory approval early next year. And so what that effectively means, that regulatory approval these days is taking a bit longer than previously. So we're hoping for our first approval in 2024. That may be the US, it may be Europe, where we're filing in parallel.
Mm. That's incredibly exciting for you to see that, because it's a long, clearly a long journey. When I just asked about the product kind of going to market, who would your customer be? Obviously, we know who the users are, but how does that work for those that might be looking at, there might be a clinician or a practitioner working within the NHS, or they've got an idea or a concept for a product or service. How easy is it to get that to market, and who is that market in a sense?
That's a great question. I think it's really important to do a lot of groundwork on this question. It depends on the particular product. In our case, and it's not about sort of going and speaking to the buyer. There is no individual. It's something that a lot of people feed into in terms of the process. So you need clinical champions as well as a very clear health economics offering. For us, it's selling in the UK. We'll be selling to NHS trusts or the ICBs. In the US, it would be selling into private hospitals. but the payers may actually be the insurers in some cases in the US. In the UK, the system is very different. In England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, it differs from each place. So strategically, it's really important to think about which healthcare system you go in first. And in England, certainly, you have to sort of do it trust by trust rather than going in at a central level. I think that differs in Scotland and Wales, for example. So this is where, when I said earlier that it's really important to talk to people and to take every opportunity that you're offered, it really comes into play, because this is something, you know, there isn't a book that you can read which will tell you this, because also the landscape is constantly changing. But what you can do is speak to people who are in that area right now, whether they're, you know, people, we've worked with people who've worked at NICE. We've spoken with people who are running centres for innovation in the NHS across the UK. We've spoken with clinicians. We've spoken with chief procurement officers at trusts to understand, actually, from your perspective, what do you need from us to be able to buy this? And I think one of the key things that generally happens, and this is the same in the corporate world, so this is one of the learnings that I had, like, really understood what they needed. On the internal side, it's anyone who you present this to, their job is then to build a business case for it and present it to their management to say, this is why it makes sense to buy this. And so you really need to appreciate and make that job as easy as possible for them. One of the pieces of work that we recently did with Eastern AHSN was actually building a template business case. So something that we can share with a potential buyer and say, hey, we've done 80% of your job. This kind of highlights what the impact could be. This is, you know, the change that you could see in your organization. This is what it would cost, and these are the benefits, and this is how quickly you'll see a return on your investment. And so the easier you can make that for them by templating as much of it as possible, the more likely that is to be a successful exchange.
Mm. Something I want to talk to you about, For context, I've got two daughters. One's currently looking at choosing A-levels at the moment. She loves biology and chemistry. Also think about maths. But understanding the career paths that those subjects might lead to it seems to be more difficult to her or for her. So she loves the subjects, but just doesn't have as much of an understanding about what that might lead to. How do you think it's best that we might encourage our children, especially girls, to pursue STEM careers?
I think visibility is incredibly important. And so having people to look at that are women in this world is almost 90% of the job done, because those are the sort of subconscious signs that you can also be there. And we've got a 70% female team at the moment. And that's very unusual in the sector. And I think one of the reasons for that is because we just happen to inspire people to come along and join us, because they can see that there are three of the co-founders are women. And so it is something that we think is really wonderful that we're able to bring in these amazing women. In terms of attracting female talent and things, I think this is one of those things that unfortunately people don't think about enough, particularly in the startup space, where you have to grow quickly and you have to hire somebody. And so it's easier if you've just interviewed 10 men, if you just happen to get 10 CVs that are all male, rather than interviewing somebody and giving the job, rather than actually thinking, okay, I need to make sure we've got more people applying to this, if you haven't had any female applicants, for example, and make sure you're talking to a wider population. Obviously, you give the job based on merit. But I think increasing that visibility and having female champions around you in your workplace helps to increase that visibility. The people in our team, for example, we very much do champion each other, and we, you know, nominate each other for awards and ensure that we are, you know, everybody in my team is uniquely exceptional and has a really great skill set, and can be a great representative, both the men and women as allies in the case of the men. We've had a number of people in our team win awards recently. So Amma Frimpong, who's our head of product development, won the IET's Young Women Engineer of the Year award last year, which was fantastic. And she was featured in all sorts of places. And so it's because, you know, these things come about because we champion each other, or we lift each other, and we make each other aware. And so we're actively doing things both internally and externally to ensure that we can increase participation in STEM subjects or the STEM world as an industry from women and young girls. Two things I'd say in particular. One thing we do externally is we, every International Women's Day in March, we run an event online where we present to young women from across the country an idea of the kind of jobs that you can undertake with STEM subjects. So when you look at a prospectus for a university offering, you see engineering or you see maths or you see maths and you think, oh gosh, you know, I don't want to be a mathematician or a maths teacher. So what am I going to do with that? Let me pick something else. There are so many potential, you know, jobs that you could do. There are so many potential things that you could do with that kind of background. And that skill set is so in demand. And it's just not that obvious when you're very young. As I mentioned earlier, two of my A-levels out of three were STEM subjects, but I had no idea what I was going to do with those because I didn't know anybody who did something in that field. And so we hold that event specifically to open up the doors to our workplace and show people what you can do with engineering or maths or biology, whatever it may be. And the other thing is, from an internal perspective, we've been very careful to build the kind of company that welcomes women and retains female talent. And this is so important. It's a really easy thing to do, but not enough people do it. So what I mean by creating that kind of workplace is that offer policies that are female friendly. Like one of the obvious examples in the startup space is often most companies will just provide statutory maternity leave. And that's not huge in this country. And I understand the rationale for it. You often think, oh, well, you know, I only have to give what the law requires me to give. But if you're competing against a big company that's offering 5 months of leave at full pay, obviously it's much, you know, any woman who thinks maybe at some point I want to have a family will actually be more attracted to that role. So you're not really keeping that playing field as open as you think. So that's one of the things we've been really keen to do and we have done is set a very fair maternity policy that's much better than statutory, because we don't want people to leave us because they think that they'll just not be able to pay their bills or not be able to take any time off if they have a child. And so these kind of policies, thinking about things like bereavement leaves, and this is one of those things that I mentioned this before about the team around me who've really inspired me and I think they make me better. But you know, someone suggested, well, that you get leave if you have a miscarriage, and it's usually after, I think, 20 weeks or something. But actually, for a woman who's expecting much earlier on, that's, you know, if you have a miscarriage before 20 weeks, it's often still very much the same experience. And so we've, you know, brought that, you know, that way back to match the experience of women, and so that you do still get some time off to grieve, to understand what you've experienced and to go through that. And these are not hard things to offer.
But they're incredibly important. I mean, yourself as a role model championing the cause and also as a company, I think it's absolutely right that you show other companies that it isn't hard. And it's just by instigating a number of, it doesn't have to be all the measures, but some, just gradually improve that environment for women to work in. So
And it benefits the company, right?
Absolutely. End of the day, you're going to increase your chances of getting, you know, you don't want to lose 50% of the amazing talent that's out there, do you?
Exactly. I think some people might be, particularly in the startup space, might be reticent because they'll think, oh, our investors might be annoyed, but they won't be. They really won't be. And if they are, they are not the right kind of investors that you want to be working with.
And these things should become the norm, shouldn't they? So, I mean, this shouldn't be the exception. It should be the rule.
Absolutely. And for us, it's always been about creating the kind of company that we'd like to see our children working in. So that means it's somewhere that's fair and, you know, champions them and makes them feel positive about what they're doing and makes them feel like they're having impact and enables them to grow. And so I think with the team around me. That's what we're on our way to doing. And I hope that by sharing some of those details around the kind of policies you can introduce to just make it a bit easier to bring female talent into your company, that, you know, others are inspired to look at their policies and do the same, even at an early stage. There's amazing female talent out there that you might be missing out on simply because your policies are just not as friendly as they should be.
Mm, thank you. So what's next? Obviously, you've got the trials coming up, and hopefully the launch or release, if you would call it that, in next year. But 52 North is a company of which NutriCheck is the first product to come out. Are you able to expand a bit more on what's in the future?
Yeah, there are lots of ideas and lots of things being executed, actually. So one of the things we've done most recently is build out our digital team. And we have recently been engaged on some work on building a digital platform for the acute oncology space. This is something that we've been quite keen to do for a long time, and it's another sort of unmet need in this space. So I think I would just say there's a lot, particularly on the digital side. The platform technology underlying the NutriCheck device is also something that can be adapted for numerous other potential cases. And so we'll be looking into that space too. But the key things that's happening that are happening right now is we're going to be going out later this year for our seed raise and looking at other opportunities there. But also growing our sort of partnerships with pharma and other collaborators in the industry. We've got two academic collaborations already running, one with Imperial, the Institute of Cancer Research, and the other with the University of Cambridge. And there's a lot of just incredible work happening out there that needs to be seen and showcased and developed into impactful technology that can improve health outcomes and improve health equity, which is our mission.
Wow. So you've obviously been working incredibly hard over the years, or since 2018 when you first formed. It might be difficult to answer this, but what's been the most enjoyable part of the whole journey for you?
That is a really tricky question. I think there have been highs along the journey, which I don't think we'll ever experience again. So the very first high of this journey was winning that prize at the Cambridge Postdoc Business Plan Competition and getting a trophy, which is still displayed on my bookcase alongside many others, thankfully, since then. I'm very fortunate.
That's the Chris Abel Business Plan Competition, isn't
absolutely.
It? Yeah, at Ideaspace, we are very fortunate to be able to sponsor the prize, one of the prizes in the form of membership to Ideaspace for those finalists.
So that's how we got our initial introduction to Ideaspace. So we were given space at Ideaspace. We were initially at the South Campus. But we didn't use it as much as we could have in those days, but we did. And that's how we were introduced to Ideaspace initially.
Yeah. So you've got, initiatives out there for helping form ideas and also form ventures really out of them. But yeah, sorry, another enjoyable part of the journey.
Yeah, so it might sound cheesy, but I would say that the most enjoyable part of it is the now. It's the everyday of it. I really love what I do. And I love that I'm still learning, and I love that I have incredible people around me from whom I can learn, whether they're my team or mentors or investors. It's such a fantastic thing to be involved in. In terms of the impact you could have, it's just so exciting to be part of that and to be driving that. And it's a different kind of drive to anything else I've ever done, because it doesn't matter how hard it might get or how challenging it might be. The potential to have impact of the type that we're talking about through NutriCheck, so really improving quality of life for cancer patients, is so exciting. And we're just constantly excited to be working with new people, working with partners to make this happen. And so honestly, every day in the office, it's just so nice because the team around me is equally excited. And so every little win is part of the big win, which will be getting this out to patients.
Yeah. I mean, obviously slightly biased, I get to see you and your team. You all genuinely do look very excited about it. So that's great to see. In terms of I guess, looking way ahead. Is there an end goal for the company? You know, it's early to talk about sort of exits and what might happen to the company. Is there an end goal to it, or are you just driven by the mission that you have at the moment?
So our aim is to be more than profit. So we want to create impact as well as obviously become a profitable company. And we recently brought on to our board somebody called Professor Sir Leszek Borysiewicz, who was the former Vice Chancellor of the University of Cambridge, but is also the current chair of Cancer Research UK. And the reason I mention this is that he is very much aligned with us on our ambition as a company to grow into a globally competitive organisation. I think it's unfortunate that far too often UK startups will have an amazing idea, do excellent execution, but then sell when they're a 30, 40 million pound company. And often that goes elsewhere outside of the UK. There is no reason why the UK can't be competing in the same way that American companies are doing. Well, there are reasons, actually. There are reasons. There are things that, funding and opportunities like that, but we have a lot of that in the UK too. Some things could be done better. I think the point is to say that we want to grow into a globally competitive company that's leading in the space of creating products like NutriCheck, which are clinical decision support tools. And we are on the way of doing that with what we have already. And hopefully after our next round, we can start developing more of our portfolio and really striving towards that goal. But that was one of the reasons that Sir Leszek joined our board. He loves our team and our ambition and is very much aligned with helping us to get to that point and really, create the kind of company that we can showcase as an example of UK innovation.
Do you know what? I think that's a wonderful place to leave this talk. You're an incredibly inspiring person and company as a whole. And if that's what the future looks like, then it's very exciting for my daughters especially. So, Amaima, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck for the future, and good luck to your team, and thanks for being so sort of honest and open with your journey. It's really appreciated.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
For more information or any inquiries about joining Ideaspace, please contact us via ideaspace.cam.ac.uk or via any of our social media channels.